So we're visiting today with Matthew Gunson from Local Motors, and maybe Horace, you could explain a bit about your interest, and Matthew, you can give us a bit of background on your work.
Okay. Sure. So I'm a director of brand management here at Local Motors, and one of the projects I put most of my time in on is our 3D printed car. It started out not quite a year ago as the Strati, which was a product of one of our design challenges on our co-creation platform. So Local Motors, we have a co-creation platform where designers, engineers from all over the world can come and contribute to which was the world's first, full-size 3D printed car. It debuted back in September at IMTS. So that's kind of a little bit of the history on Local Motors and what we're doing right now. We also in the past we had the first co-created vehicle to hit the road, which was the Rally Fighter. That's been on the road for, I'm not exactly sure the number of years, but it's been several years now. It's kind of a it's kind of a Baja style racer, and then we've also put out a few other different types of vehicles. Another one that we've created is the Verado, which is kind of a which is called a drift trike, which is kind of like an electric powered big wheel, a fun little vehicle. It's got a wheel-mounted motor in the front. But we also have a micro factory program where we are, which I think is one of the really interesting things that attracted me to what we do here when I was considering the opportunity here, which basically allows us to produce on a small scale the products that come out of the co-creation community. So, for example, a micro factory requires about $10 million in capital, where obviously, a full-size factory is going to, I think, in preparation, I looked at, I think Volkswagen just started in 2011 or 12 a plant in Tennessee, and they put $1 billion into that. So
right.
Obviously it's, a few magnitudes of, a few order of magnitudes less in cost, and that's kind of what makes it interesting.
And that billion went into a site that was a greenfield site that probably also had all kinds of tax breaks to welcome them there. So I think BMW gave a figure for their SUV plant in the, is it North or South Carolina?
Right.
South Carolina, a $9 billion total investment over a couple of years, 6-7 years. But that's not, so it's not just even the billion you start with, it's the billion that you add every year. So let me ask, let me try to wrestle this description down to the barest. What's in it for me in this sense? So let's say I have an idea, and I'm an entrepreneur, and I do have an idea. I have an idea of building my own car. And I am building, I'm doing an EV conversion on a Volkswagen Beetle. But let's say I would like to do an EV conversion on a more recent, more complex vehicle. Let's say I was also interested in ultimately doing EV conversions for other people. Let's say then I move from that learning process to let me actually design my own vehicle. Now, how would Local Motors help me to get into the car making business?
So right now, the way the process would be, like, you could go onto our co-creation site at localmotors.com, and to get there, you go there, you hit the explore tab, and then we have different, there's challenges, there's design challenges, there's projects, there's a few different categories where you can kind of contribute. So, you know, for example, if you're doing an EV conversion, that could start out as a personal project on the site where, you know, you would have access to the community members who could contribute their, you know, their knowledge. And we also have engineers, we have engineers here who kind of help manage the community and contribute as well. So it becomes kind of this, it becomes a community project and an open source development opportunity where you're able to tap, you know, resources from all around the world and contribute their knowledge to your project. So it'd be a matter of getting on the platform, setting up an account, then, uploading the information through whether, you know, it's pictures or video or, you know, written content.
So, but what is your business model? Where, how does money change hands here?
So, like, for example, what you're asking is how would you eventually make money from your project?
No, not just myself, but it's
Local Motors, right?
Yeah. How does Local Motors make money? And from that, we can work out how it affects me as well, but. Just as in theory, how does
so
it...
So the $10 million investment, so how do you get that back with a return, Matthew?
Right. So so we're right now the projects, certain projects will get produced. So projects that, we'll start a design challenge for a certain project. Other projects have started within the community itself, and then they'll get... You know, they'll get selected for production. So, for example, with the Strati, that was a project that, became a design challenge. And then, you know, designers submitted their designs from all over the world. And then it was, requirements. There was a feasibility kind of check to see if it met the requirements of the challenge. And then after that, the ones that met requirements were voted on, and then the winner, was produced. Now, in the case of the Strati, it was basically intended to be, a prototype and not intended to go on that particular model, not intended to be sold quite yet. We are working now on kind of a second generation that will eventually be for sale to the public. The projects are protected by Creative Commons license, and contributors are remunerated at 4%. So, people who contribute on the projects get remunerated at 4%.
So you are really then you would make a car based on an open source license, get a return on your investment based on selling that vehicle while paying some royalty. Does that add up?
Yeah.
Correct?
Okay. Yeah.
So you really are not, so let me put it this way. Gordon Murray's idea is that he doesn't get involved in manufacturing. He doesn't get involved even in factory design. He gets involved in designing the vehicle for which he takes a license. But then expect someone to go forward and invest in production and pay the royalty to him for any units sold. Now, you're almost the exact opposite, where you're actually investing in production and saying, let the design be outsourced or open sourced in a way to any number of people. Is that the right way to think about this? Is sort of the in contrast to, let's say, the iStream logic?
I apologize, Horace. I lost about 40 seconds of 30 seconds of that. Could you rephrase the question? I apologize.
Okay, so just to try to contrast, so understand your business logic relative to Gordon Murray's iStream. Mm-hmm. And so iStream is as I understand it, the logic is that they actually get paid for design. And someone else gets paid for manufacturing, and they set up a plant, or rather, you set up a plant as the licensor. Mm-hmm. I should say the licensee here. So they are the licensor, you are the licensee. You set up a plant, you put up the money, they sell you license for the design. In your case, you actually are working the opposite way. That is, you are investing in the plant, and then you allow the designers to come in and offer designs, essentially. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, the latter is basically what we're doing, yeah.
So it's interesting. It's a quite a different model, but it also the thing that you have in common is still the idea that the vehicle is not going to be fabricated in the way that it all has been historically. I think right. you're both, although probably asymmetric to each other, you're still asymmetric fundamentally to the incumbent model and the integrated manufacturing model of the auto industry, and in particular. What you're grasping, I think, is the modularity potential here, right? That if you have an industry that modularizes deeply, then all kinds of ways of getting the product built can be enabled, and so that's really fundamentally what this is about. So I think in that sense, you're actually very similar to Gordon Murray thought process here. Would you agree? Would you say that's exactly what you're taking advantage of?
Yeah, as we look forward, we're putting a lot of emphasis. You know, we are becoming a 3D or direct digital manufacturing company for automotive that uses co-creation to bring the vehicles that the community wants to see created to market. So, we're definitely and it's really exciting because. It does give us the opportunity to scale, I think of it as horizontally and vertically, not horizontally, not across demographics, but scale, by one word we use is scope, scale by scope, or, scale by the use or the need of the individual. If you look at the U.S. is basically a saturated auto market, you've got essentially one car for every driver. And, if I heard an interview of, I think it was a Ford executive on NPR a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking about, India and China being their areas for growth in the future and not really looking at the U.S. as an opportunity for growth, maybe very incremental or very slight growth. But with this approach, we see there being great opportunity to scale even in a saturated market because we can we can be more modular in our approach to what types of vehicles are built in what locations and how they fit the needs and jobs of particular customers.
Right. So, Jim, you have a question?
I do. So where so let's see this through a few more years, and so you're creating these vehicles, where can they be used? Are you operating? Are you sort of flying under the radar of one of our guests a while ago? Was talking about the sub 35 mile per hour market having different regulations, or are you targeting off road, or it doesn't matter because we're talking about prototype style vehicles? Or tell us about the actual entry into the market. Is this simply a vinyl thing? Right. I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's interesting. Pretty much all of what you just said, we are taking into consideration. We're currently working with some universities to create basically mules, test beds for systems and materials, and then we'll be taking what we learned from that and turning that into an NEV, a neighborhood electric vehicle. With the end goal of having a highway-ready car fully homologated by the end of 2016, which is a tall task.
the incumbents, I think years ago Toyota was maybe turning a new platform every 3 to 4 years. I don't think they're that frequent now. I think they're more on 7 years, for a whole new deal. So, wow, that's pretty good—a year and a half.
Yeah, and
what is the outcome? Is that a road going vehicle, or is that simply a prototype that sub 35 miles an hour?
That will be a highway. The intent is for that to be a highway ready, fully homologated, tested vehicle.
So 80 miles an hour, 90, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ready for purchase. Yeah, so like I said, it's a tall task, but our our belief is that through the community, through co-creation, and through direct digital manufacturing, we can get there.
You can do it.
Yeah.
So. And do you have any? Are you religious about the powertrain, or are you completely agnostic?
Do you mean like gas, or like do you mean internal combustion versus hybrid versus electric?
Yes.
We're right now very much in the electric side of things, and there's a lot of good reasons for that. Obviously, I think looking to the future, eventually, you know, electric will be, you know, I think electric's going to fit consumer needs well. Is obviously there's range anxiety, but you know, the hope is that that problem will be addressed over time, and you know, people will turn to electric for a lot of reasons. Obviously, servicing an electric vehicle is a lot less costly. The electric motors are extremely dependable, almost, you know, nearly fail safe, and so it also makes the rest of the car, you know, easier design. Right now, we're looking at a direct drive electric vehicle, which obviously eliminates transmission, eliminates a lot of the problems people, consumers typically will have with their car and taking it in for service, for example. So,
of course, your bill of materials is night and day, but you're still subject to the, assuming some sort of a market entry, right, beyond prototypes, you're still subject to the regulatory regime in states, and at least in the U.S., right? And you know, we've talked again in previous shows about the different places to start that you might avoid some of those challenges. So, I mean, how cognizant are you of those things? And is that, you know, who's carrying that water for you, or are they?
Well, it's kind of a two-part answer. So the first part of it is you know, as a brand director of brand management here, you know, my job is primarily to understand the fit for the consumer and how we message to the consumer, how we solve their, you know, their vehicle-related needs. And, you know, and also interfacing with our co-creation community and taking what we learn from consumers and, you know, injecting that into the co-creation community in order to get problems solved. So one, that's that question is a little bit outside of my scope. Two, I do know that we have, that's one of the parts that, one of the parts of the puzzle that we're taking into consideration and trying to address, you know, through, in part through our co-creation community, in part through our staff. And, you know, the goal is, like I said, to have a fully homologated vehicle, highway ready. So, you know, we also have the, like I said, we're also going to have an NEV. So in one form or another, we, you know, we'll be able to, have vehicles, where we need to have them, or where people need to have them, I should say, actually, to be more accurate.
So, okay, so let me try to, this is the challenge is to, you have an abundance of design. You have a design, when I look at your website, I don't know how many designs you can see there, and there's a
wide range, yes.
Yeah, there's a wide range, military right. vehicles, scooters,
off-road,
everything.
Off-road, everything, yep.
But there are very few actual prototypes that we can touch.
Yeah.
So is the how do you make the decision as to what gets built?
Yeah. So, part of the decisions that have been made and that are being made are strategic ones. You know, it was a strategic decision to focus on 3D printing as a production process. So, you know, we had, for example, that the challenge for the Strati, and then we had another challenge that we titled Project Redacted that was, you know, to kind of create the follow-up to the Strati, which will be the precursor for the highway-ready car. But other than that, I mean, well, we've obviously created the Rally Fighter. We've created the Verado. There's a motorcycle we've called the Racer, or created called the Racer. other than that, a lot of the projects on the site are, you know, like I said, they're individual projects that people are looking for input on. There's other, like, you know, they have, kind of, projects where you can just, you know, post your design ideas. So there's a lot of content there that is, you know, to help build up the community, to help strengthen the community, to help grow the community, that isn't being fed directly into, you know, a production process. So, you know, we anticipate that 3D printing is going to allow us to, in the future, to more, to address the needs of consumers in the community a little bit better.
I just read this morning, actually, after I was at the gym, I don't know if I pronounced this correctly, Dazine, it's a Dazine, anyway, it's an architecture publisher, and they assert that 3D printing is running into substantial problems because of the cost of materials there. One designer who worked in fashion mentioned that they're having to pay $65 per kilo for the supplies, and that they can't compete with injection molding. So do you have any sense of how that's playing out, Matthew, the old versus the new, let's say?
Yeah, so, I mean, for the most part, I mean, we're working with the cost of the material, and when you eliminate the cost of tooling, which is the case for us.
Billions of dollars, yeah.
Right, yeah. That the comparative cost is advantageous. Again, you know, we will win by doing, you know, 10,000, 10,000, 10,000, 10,000, rather than, you know,
500 million or 500,000 or
exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's how we have to address the market is, you know, we're going to make money on the first 10,000. We got to repeat that over and over. Mm-hmm. So, and that because that's we don't have to put up those costs for tooling and you know our material I don't think is running at something like $65 you know a pound or whatever or at that kind of cost but you know it's certainly a cost that goes into production and it's one that we're always kind of we're working with you know we part of what we're doing is also exploring. You know, we've been working with a material that's ABS and carbon fiber composite. Mm. That's what the Strati was made from. We're also testing other materials. There's a material called Ninja Flex, which is more of a flexible material, which could be used in certain parts of the car. Probably can't make an entire car out of it. There's another product similar to it called SemiFlex, which is firmer. But we anticipate that over time, the pricing of the materials will become more favorable, and you know it's always going to outrun or undercut the pricing of tooling.
There was an interview with Bob Lutz a couple weeks ago. I don't know one of the publications, and he was a relatively well-known auto executive, now retired. But he mentioned, and I'm sort of getting to the market question here. He mentioned that. Performance cars or luxury cars can no longer be differentiated based on performance. It's all aesthetics. It's all the soft stuff. And this follows maybe 6 months ago, Cadillac's new Austin-based, or I think she's from Austin, brand manager talking about how it's not about the car. It's about everything else. And so my question to you as you think about 2016 and 2017 is, are the things that you're creating sort of playing into that? You know, it's more the experience, right? More the aesthetics than, you know, Horace going around the corner in the Porsche quickly or me, you know, going through the hills faster, driving across Europe or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And so are you really riding that, you know, sort of more personalized wave? Is that your intention?
I think that's a great question. And we have the capability certainly to quickly, you know, quickly prototype, quickly develop, quickly get on the road, you know, cars that can be differentiated aesthetically, you know, more of them and more quickly. However, I think there's a lot to be said about utility. You know, as I've been doing some of the research around the jobs to be done, in the vehicle space, you learn a lot of interesting things. You learn how people use their cars, what's frustrating about them, and one of the pieces of research I did, we looked at track cars and discovered, wow, there's a massive switching cost involved with track cars and reclassifying and that type of thing. So, is there an opportunity to create a car that could be a first and last car that could be moved from road to track to road as, the career or the life of the user evolves? So I think there's a lot to be said for utility. And honestly, I think that's, I guess I would go counter to what they're saying. And I think that there's a lot of money to be made in addressing jobs of users better. I think for the most part, cars aren't terribly, well, yes and no. I mean, I want to say cars aren't terribly differentiated on based on jobs. You've got trucks, you've got SUVs, you've got passenger cars, you've got commuter cars, but I think there's a lot of space within each of those segments to better address consumer needs and jobs to be done.
Beyond what's happening today with the myriad of slicing and dicing markets and Mercedes going from a single digit to three digits because of the explosion in their models, their portfolio, and all that. So you think there's unexplored niches or opportunities in the utility of the car? It could be.
Oh, hello?
Hello.
Yeah, sorry. I think I cut out a bit there. Could you repeat that, Jim?
Sure. I just said, so we're now in an era where Mercedes has gone from a single digit to three digits in their car naming scheme because their portfolio has expanded so much, right?
Yeah.
And they're not unique. And so you're essentially asserting that there are unexplored jobs to be done or utilities in the auto or the transport space. And I wouldn't disagree with that, but
yeah.
Interesting.
I think there is, because I think when you look at what BMW is doing, what Mercedes is doing, what Audi has done, going from having a A4 and A6 and A8 to having a 5,
right.
7, and they probably have a 9 in the works.
Mm-hmm.
I think really you're looking at two dimensions of performance. Well, one dimension of performance primarily, which is power, and you're looking at occupancy, and you're looking at and you're looking at cost. And yeah, they're filling up the grid, they're filling up the spaces on the grid with cost and with size and power, but I think there's, like I said, I think there's still a lot to be done in meeting more specific needs, and obviously direct digital manufacturing, 3D printing gives us that opportunity.
Can you talk about the microfactory concept and locations?
Yeah. So we're actually, it's really an interesting time where we're at right now. I mean, if you were to come tour our facility right now, we've been building cars that were basically tubular steel chassis, frames, and now we're moving into 3D printing. So the microfactories were built originally to be able to produce, localized vehicles that were using more traditional, we weren't doing sheet steel or stamped steel, but we were using these frames and chassis as a basis. So originally they were done for that, and now they're going to be a little bit different. We're going to have, we're working on a location that will be opening. I'm actually not sure of the date right offhand, but it'll be opening in National Harbor in Washington, D.C. Around November, and that will have, I think, either three or four large 3D printers in it, and you know, so that'll be, and then there'll be a community, there'll be a space for the community called, we call labs, where they can come in and work on projects or contribute to projects, and there'll be a retail space as well.
Okay.
So it's, they're going to be, they're going to have the ability to be built in urban spaces. They do have the ability to be built in urban spaces.
We have plenty of big boxes around, so that's probably not a bad strategy. Yeah. Although 3D gaming is starting to eat some of those, by the way. Interesting.
I've seen a couple of those pop up.
Yeah. Anyway. Interesting. So, and are these, are you guys doing these directly? Or are these sort of a franchise expansion model, or what's that look like?
Directly with some partnerships. Mm-hmm. To the best of my knowledge.
Cool. That makes sense.
So, but where are the? So you have Phoenix, Las Vegas, Crystal City, Virginia, right? And then what's next?
Hello. Sorry, Horace. You're asking where they are.
Yeah, and where they're going to be.
So we have, well, obviously we're speaking from the Chandler, Arizona location, which is just south of Phoenix. We have the National Harbor one,
right?
Which is going to be a sales and demonstration center. We also have another. Let's see, we have Knoxville location. We're in the process of constructing right now, Knoxville, Tennessee, and then. We have another site planned for trying to remember.
Is there a analogy or perhaps a parallel, Matthew, to what you're doing with these, let's say, niche markets for now with the motorcycle business? One of my college roommates who's been with Intel quite some time, likes motorcycles, and he always seems to have a obscure brand. And I'm, you know, really unaware. I don't know much about that space, really. But is that sort of the tangent or the market that your organization sees, those folks that are looking for that special aesthetic or special experience, or the maker thing, right, or part of that anyway?
Yeah, I think it's been. I mean, if you look at our history, it's been a little bit of both of that. It's been, you know, people who want to be hands-on. For example, the Rally Fighter is a build experience. So, you know, due to some of those regulations you were talking about earlier, Jim, and the fact that it's a co-created vehicle using, for the most part, you know, off-the-shelf parts. You know, it's classified as a kit car, basically, and the people who buy it, they come down to the microfactory and they participate in the build experience, because of that. So they participate in 51% of the build of the vehicle, and so yes, historically that's really been kind of who we are. The Rally Fighter is a very niche vehicle. You know, it's designed to be something that could kind of handle anything off road, but you could still drive it to the store. you know, we have customers who do that with it. So, it's a niche, and the racer as well, same situation. You know, it's kind of a niche, vehicle, for people who are interested in, unique designs, and want to have kind of a hands-on experience. Going forward, I think that we're really looking at a different type of, we need to address more people, certainly. And we need to be able to do that through, meeting their needs better and become, I think, more of a, I think we need to use direct digital manufacturing to kind of win on the utility side of things and understanding jobs to be done with consumers.
One of the utilities that I've been surprised has not come back much in the States, and maybe it's the decline of longer distance driving. I don't know, but I saw an announcement that Volkswagen is creating another version of their camping van in Europe, the California, recently. And of course, it's named California, which is cool, but it won't be sold in California, just in Europe. But you know, maybe those are some of the niches that will emerge out of this, you know, these sort of transport, maybe the people that go work for some of the Silicon Valley companies and can't afford rent, but they can live in their, you know, their local motors van or something, you know, maybe it'll come back. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
Hey, another question on the organization. So you have, according to your website, 107 employees. How are you funded?
Well, we've been funded through, you know, we're selling the products, but a lot of it's been a lot of investment. So that's still a path we're going down. You know, I anticipate that we're going to be able, you know, the plan is obviously for us to create these vehicles that will fit well into people's lives, and there'll be a demand for them. So, you know, we're working on that business model, but primarily we've been funded through investment at this point.
So is it raised through venture money?
Not privy to those conversations firsthand, but my understanding is primarily private. Mm-hmm.
So private funding, that's a fairly large, looks like a large cost structure for the sales volumes. I'm just curious whether your next step is to raise more money, or is it maybe it's beyond scope of this conversation. The money has to be one of the ways we analyze things here.
I understand it.
Right. I mean, you know, creating very, very small runs, you know, 1 to 5 units, probably, unless it's a big service business, it's hard to see big dollars coming out of that.
Sure. Well, we're privately funded by people who are, you know, really believe in our ability to disrupt the automotive industry. And, you know, that's what we're trying to do. So, it's
a noble goal.
Yeah, it's a noble goal. Yeah, but I think we're really taking, you know, a very different approach to how, you know, to the industry, and addressing the needs of customers through co-creation, you know, taking input from consumers and rolling that into our co-creative community and designing and building and putting on the road vehicles that'll really fit the needs and jobs to be done of customers.
Do you envision financing these things at all?
I think there's a few different models that are really interesting to explore when it comes to, you know, how you're bringing revenue in. And that's one of them. I know that there's some that creates other hurdles that have to be considered.
Sure.
And I would hope that we get, I hope that we're able to get to a point where, you know, we're considering alternatives to traditional ownership.
Right.
And because I think one way for us to be successful, I'll speak in my opinion here based on, you know, what I've learned in interviewing consumers and understanding what we're trying to do. I think one way for us to be successful is to sell with the car the idea that it's going to become a better product. So, you know, version one of the iPhone, while a great product for its time, would be very crude right now. And, you know, and that's only, what is that, Horace, 7 years down the road?
Roughly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if we can, because the great thing about direct digital manufacturing is it allows us to integrate what we learn and what we create and what we design and technology as it evolves or as it improves into the vehicle more quickly. So through a cycle of about 5 months, we can, you know, have an iterative loop.
Mm-hmm. And so concept,
yes,
prototype, review, yeah, production. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So if we can, you know, have people buying version one, And understand that version 2, 3, 4, and 5 are coming quickly and going to be much improved, you know, I think that's a way for us to potentially win.
What sort of price range when you talk with people? What do you envision a price range for these things, Matthew?
Yeah, I could tell you what I'd hope it would be at.
I understand.
Like, okay, so I'll tell you my personal – what I drive a Honda Fit.
Okay.
I bought it used. Cool. Nice car. I bought it used for $10,000 and I love it.
Yep.
It does a lot of things for me. I can fold down the back seats and it's got you know, as much space as a Ford Explorer in the back.
Right.
You know, it's got headroom for my son who's 6 foot three in the back seat. You know, it's a
great car, no doubt.
Even though it's underpowered, it feels like a sports car when I drive it because it handles so well.
Yes.
So, you know, I pay, you know, my payment on that car is just under $200 because, you know, I bought it used. So as I look at what we can offer, man, it would be awesome if we could be in that range, whether that's on a subscription basis, a lease or whatever the case might be. Because some of the designs that have come out of our most recent challenge, I've looked at and I've thought, man, if that was the same price, I'd really consider that, knowing that, this is, you know, V1.0 and, you know, 1.1 and 2.0 are going to be a lot better, and they're coming soon.
I'll tell you why I asked that question. I drove a i3 maybe 16 months ago, winter of 2014, I guess, 2014, and I happened to be traveling recently, and I was going past a BMW dealer, and I noticed several parked out front with the usual car dealer colored signs in the window. You know, I think one had a $5,500 rebate, another one had a $7,000 or $7,300 rebate, and then they had a lease deal of $369 a month. Mm-hmm. And I, when they were sort of, you know, following up and contacting me about buying it, of course, I ask about the rates and the lease deals, because that sort of gives you a feel for what they believe the value will be. And, yep, you know, the risk when you're entering like that, and I suspect it's something they've thought about quite a bit, is, you know, when we put these out there, what, you know, what are our risks over the next 3 to 4 to 5 years? Because version 2 certainly will be much better than that first one. And in your case, you know, that price point, I imagine, will determine success significantly in that first round.
Certainly it's going to be really important. And, you know, there's also the idea to consider that there's going to be a group of people who are really going to be really excited to buy this car because they are really interested in the technology.
Right. And maybe that's enough.
Well, I mean, if we make money, 10,000, 10,000, 10,000, it might be. However, I think ultimately we need to find a way to become a solution that's within reach of a large number of people.
Right. Right. So when you think about the one of the other topics we've discussed on a SIM car is the declining interest amongst younger people in cars and driving and all these things. And, you know, Horace has a nephew we've talked about, and I have a friend's son who's now 18. He still doesn't have his driver's license. And it's quite interesting. And so when you think about the target demographics, so, you know, you've got this new thing that has a fascinating process, probably offers some interesting personalization, has a certain cachet versus the run-of-the-mill other cars. I mean, how big is that market? Are we talking about, of the people who understand driving for the near term, I mean, how many of them would value that? Do you think it's 5% or 2% or 10% or 2-1?
That's a tough question to answer. You know, that's tough to answer. I mean, I think you get into, I think that we can address needs of just about any person who's interested in mobility. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I mean, you know, we're not going to come out with, you know, 100 different versions of a car right away, you know, but, ultimately I think the goal is that we can address the needs of just about anybody. And that said, you know, I hope, my hope is that equally we'd be able to be accessible to people's budgets in the same way. I don't necessarily think that's how things will be right off the start, but right off the block. But I think ultimately that's the direction we, you know, would be advantageous for us to pursue.
Sure. Tesla. Yeah. Go ahead, Horace.
Jim, you're going to mention Tesla. I think.
Well, the only reason I mentioned that their market entrance was the Lotus chassis, right?
Yeah.
And they said, all right, we're going to do sort of what Horace was describing, an EV conversion of this thing. You know, we're going to put some retail spots in, you know, what I suppose they considered, or some people consider, hip locations to get the brand awareness. And that was how they started building it, right? And, you know, how it plays out, who knows. But that was their first, and that was a very high-end, very expensive toy to begin with.
But, yeah, and I think here we are definitely, you know, more interested in starting not at the top, Tesla, not at the very top, like Tesla's done, mm-hmm. and being more accessible.
Horace, you have a question?
Yeah, I am really intrigued by the potential for different models that could emerge from modularity, and I think that modularity, as you see already, you know, spawning your experiment and spawning Tesla as an experiment and iStream. What I'm curious is whether there's, you know, once I was watching Top Gear and they were talking, I think they were interviewing Jay Leno, and they were doing the Honda, they were doing a segment on the Honda Clarity, I think it was,
their hydrogen
right. car.
Yeah.
And they interviewed Jay Leno, you know, this segment was filmed in L.A., and Jay Leno said, you know, he has a huge collection of antiques and collectible cars, and he said, you know, he wants to see electric cars succeed. He's a big petrol head. He loves motors, but he wants to see the electric car succeed, or the hydrogen car, because that's what we're going to use every day. But he thinks of these old cars as the way people do about horses today. Just something that they're passionate about. They use for leisure. They use for weekend amusements and it's more of a hobby. So his vision of the world, and I it's one I share, is that we're going to have it split between cars used for the job to be done of passion, nostalgia, history. Hands-on, do-it-yourself. There are jobs to be done that people have that around vehicles that are not embodied by the transportation logic. Transportation logic is a utilitarian logic. Everything else is an emotional logic. And what intrigues me is the opportunity for your company or others to reorient themselves, especially as a niche, away from utility towards emotion, in order to meet those nascent or perhaps I would say even not nascent but latent jobs that exist, things that are under the surface. As speaking for myself, and I think Jim probably can relate to this, is that we have a lot of, you know, as you reach middle age, you carry a lot of nostalgia. You carry a lot of nostalgia as a burden. That's a burden we got to bear.
Why are you not converting a 911 or 944 horse?
Yeah, so that's my long-winded question is I'm socializing this idea because a lot of people I've talked to, they have different points of view. I mean, I talked to German enthusiasts who are like, they would never dream of an EV conversion on a classic car because they would, you know, they're like all about having the numbers must match. Mm-hmm. Even if the part is completely rusted out, you got to put it in there. And so there's the purists. And then you have other people who are really saying, let's have the best of both worlds. Let's have the design, the charm, the beauty, of the old with the technology of the new. So this is the American hot rodder. I think it's a modern hot rod. The modern hot rod is going to be an EV car. It's going to be an EV conversion. And so what I'm wondering is whether you think about, you know, a lot of the stuff I see on your site, some of it is kind of interesting fusion of old and new. Some of it is all new. It's harder to win with all new, in my opinion, because you've got to homologate the, as you put it, to the car. But if you take an old vehicle that's already been, you know, it's already been a vehicle that's got an inspection done on it, and then you convert it, suddenly you have a new vehicle
and a different that's, path to
that, that that's yeah. still roadworthy, that's right. still safety. You know, well, as much as safety was possible back when it was built, but anyway, so that's what I'm toying with, and I think that this is just I'm throwing it out there because I kind of sense it in my bones more than I have any evidence for, but I sense that in another 20 years, there'll be a large market that will be all about nostalgia, putting old vehicles back on the road, and the same way look, my wife loves horses, and it is the 21st century. So the fact that people love horses does not change. They love horses then, they love horses now. So the people are going to love their cars into the future for reasons other than their utility. So sure. so anyway, just something to think about when you look at your vision and you look at your jobs to be done research, just be mindful of the emotional, the charm, the beauty, the things about cars that make us all irrational. And that's the stuff I think that's going to be you can see it in the fact that so many manufacturers are putting out retro cars today.
Yeah. Well, sure, the Camaro, the Mustang, and the yeah. Hemi in the States, of course. Yeah.
Well, you know, in fact, in the way of putting it this way, sort of like my axiom would be, or my hypothesis would be, as soon as an industry turns to retro, you know it's over. You do.
It's the last
gasp.
We're going to mine it for as much as we can. Yeah.
You know, Lenovo just said they're going to put out a retro ThinkPad. You know it's over. You know it's over. It's over because they say the best ideas were those we had before.
Nostalgia.
And we're going to bring them back because yeah. that is anyway, that's my thing.
So, Matthew, you have it. There it is.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because the racer actually is that's exactly what the racer is. It's a Harley that's basically been customized or converted into this new customized or more differentiated looking vehicle. So and that's a lot of what our roots are. You know, our roots are very much people who are really passionate about cars and building cars and designing cars. That's really what our foundation is. And I certainly wouldn't, you know, in the immediate future, we have a direction that we're headed with changing, you know, really disrupting the production process for automotive. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't rule out our ability to do things like that future.
Anyway, I think our time is coming to an end. I just wanted to thank you. I'm afraid I have a hard stop now because I got to run to another thing. But yes. But I'd love to stay in touch. And I mentioned I have a selfish interest, and that is because as I said, I'm doing an EV conversion of my own, and I'd love to see how you guys can help out, and or I can help you in some way, because this EV conversion is not a new thing, but I still feel that it's something that's really, really low under the radar, that has a lot of legs, and it's interesting. So I'd love to catch up with you on that as well.
Indeed, yeah. And Matthew, if you have some links you'd like us to include in the show notes, please forward those. But thanks again for your time. It's always good to learn some more, and Horace, catch you next time.
Especially someone who's doing something so innovative and so disruptive. It's always great to have
absolutely
you guys on enlighten us.
Awesome, thank
great.
You. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Thanks,
all right,
guys.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.